Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, at least 2 weeks in advance of your event date. Space is limited, so submissions are considered in the order that they are received. The Social Justice Calendar is yet another way that WPFW connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash, Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
With Two Heels in the Seat. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Joni.
I'm going to ask you a question in a moment, but I want to share that we're going to be speaking with Clarence Hussein for the hour and talking about the topic of, I'm not feeling too well today, organizing against racial authoritarianism. Lessons from the past, preparing for the present. And I'm going to introduce Clarence a little more in a moment, but I wanted Chuck to share. Every year for the last 25 years, Chuck has organized something called Bread for the Soul, which provides support in the form of gifts, food, and more to families, children and families with HIV/AIDS, and women in homeless shelters. And he does this every year around the Christmas holiday. And Chuck, could you share, you had a very wonderful event yesterday, and in about 2 weeks or the week from Saturday, you're going to be delivering the toys and gifts to the families. And you need a little help. So could you share with listeners what, if they might want to help you out, what should they do? Or tell us what
Joni,
they did.
We do it two ways. On the Friday the 20th, we'll pack all the toys and coats and gifts, certificates, put them in boxes or bags, shopping bags, and then on Saturday the 21st, we'll deliver them from 905 6th Street Southwest, the party room. And that starts at 8:30, and people come and they get a family's name, a two or three family's name, and they go out and make the deliveries. And we try to get this done by 12 o'clock so that people have the rest of their afternoon to do their shopping. And it's the week before Christmas. And then, of course, the families don't have to wait all day. We give them a time and a period in terms of when we'll be there. And it's just a wonderful experience. If you've never done it, it's worth having that experience. And secondly, if you've done it, come back because we need you. We have over 47 families we'll be delivering to. So the more drivers we have, the more you can do it. And I can be reached at 202-421-8608. That's 202-421-8608. Or you can text me.
Okay, and I know that you say that this is to support families and children with HIV/AIDS, and I wasn't aware that HIV/AIDS was still impacting children. Is that true? Uh huh.
Yes, it is, and of course, the highest number, the cases of AIDS in D.C. still is rising, and the highest numbers are in Ward 7 and 8.
Of course, and we aren't hearing too much about HIV/AIDS, so what you're doing makes that even more important, Chuck. I know there are people who, adults who have had AIDS, years ago and are still suffering from the impact of AIDS, many people. But I wasn't aware that children are still getting AIDS. So thank you for what you're doing. And again, that's going to be a week from Saturday, December 21st. You're going to be delivering a meeting in Southwest to help deliver the presents and the food. And tell us again the phone number.
202-421-8608, Chuck Hicks. Or you can text me.
Okay, very good. And at some time in the near future, we will focus on the story about what's happening with our so-called health insurance system in this country. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about United Healthcare and the murder of the executive director and the fact that tens of thousands of people are being denied care. So we will talk about that in the future. I understand that United Healthcare serves something like 50 million people, if I'm not mistaken. And many, many people are impacted by the denial of care. Many people die. And it's interesting that there's no requirement to even keep track of the lack of what happens when people are denied care. So we will discuss that in the future. But today we're happy to be spending the hour with Clarence Lussain. Clarence, of course, has been very much a part of the WPFW family since the beginning, since we started, I believe, in 1977. But of course, he's done a lot more. For over 30 years, Clarence has written about and been active in national and international anti-racism politics, globalization, U.S. foreign policy, human rights, and issues such as education and drug policy. He's the former chair of the board of the National Alliance of Third World Journalists. And reading about, I encourage everybody, people who are interested, know Clarence, to read up about what he's done. It's a remarkable list of things that we're not going to go over all of them, but we're very happy to have Clarence on for the hour. Of course, Clarence is an author. He's a professor now at Howard University, political science. He's written numerous books, include the Black History of the White House, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman, and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. And we thought this was a good time to have Clarence on. Of course, it's always a good time, but since the election, it raises a lot of questions about where we're going in this country. The issue of fascism is something that people have been talking about. But when I spoke to Clarence, he used the concept of racial authoritarianism, and how do we organize against racial authoritarianism, lessons from the past, and preparing for the future. So good morning, Clarence.
Good morning, Joni, and good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Clarence.
So, Chuck, thank you for the work you're doing.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
And so, Clarence, racial authoritarianism. Tell us what that means and why you think that in this particular context and where we're heading in 2025, that is a more accurate description rather than, or perhaps talk about what's the difference between racial authoritarianism and fascism, or how are they linked?
Okay, so thank you for again for having me. So I use the concept of racial authoritarianism because when we look at what has evolved as the nature of the U.S. state, and particularly under Trump, what we see is an authoritarianism where the pushback on democracy has accelerated and will be consolidating more and more under Trump. But it's an authoritarianism that's completely rooted in the racism and the racial history of the country. And that's critical because there are a lot of us, of course, who have been fighting for racial justice, but not always looking at the kind of authoritarianism side of what's going on. And then on the other side, there are those who are fighting to expand and defend democracy, but do not necessarily see the link with the racism and the racial history of the country. And so racial authoritarianism as a concept captures those two elements. And we saw this in this election that just unfolded. When Trump runs on immigration, this isn't immigration at large. This is an immigration that's completely racially defined. And when Trump talks about poisoning the blood, and he talks about enemy of the people and migrant crime, all of that is framed in concepts of the racial other, particularly Black and brown people. And so we should not dismiss that as central to what will be going forward. And the Trump part two will be much worse than Trump's first term for a number of reasons. One is that the Supreme Court has basically said Trump has immunity from anything he does. And we know from his first term where he committed crime after crime after crime, and the immorality and unethical behavior was pretty much on display every day, and the corruption will take on an even worse form this time because Trump has pretty much no constraints. Also, Trump is lame duck, so he cannot run again. So there's no pressure around re-election. One of the things we talk about it in political science presidents is when a president is first elected, the first thing they do is start running for a second term. So Trump will not be encumbered by that at all. So it will be all and everything from day one. And so we should be really, really kind of focused on the extremism that will start to manifest. Now, I draw a distinction, and there are scholars that do, between authoritarianism and fascism. Under fascism, the Constitution is suspended, the judiciary and the legislative are shut down, there's rampant political violence, there's mass incarceration of political opponents, versus authoritarianism, where you see erosion happening on democratic levels. You see the walls of democracy start to unfold. You start to see capitulation coming from political forces. But there's still space for political organizing that doesn't exist under fascism and speaking out. So for example, under an authoritarian state, WPFW probably and maybe could exist. Under fascism, it could not. And so it's important to draw those distinctions so that we are best aware of the political grounds on which we can organize.
Although we hear that some of the people that are working with Trump are talking about Troy, and I think this is written up in Project 2025, doing away with the public media.
Oh, absolutely. So I think they are going to go after PBS, National Public Radio, or NPR. They're going to go after mainstream press to the degree that they can. How far that goes will depend on a number of different factors. But what we're already seeing is that particularly with some of the major media that's controlled by billionaires, the Washington Post and LA Times is two examples, that they've already capitulated and they've already surrendered. So to a degree, there's not as much effort is going to be needed if these newspapers and these media are self-limiting themselves. And so that we see, but that's different than outlawing the media. But there's certainly people who are coming into Trump's orbit from Stephen Miller to Steve Bannon to Cash Patel to Sebastian Gorka, who ideologically are much closer to fascism than authoritarianism, in my opinion.
And is this concept of racial authoritarianism, is that being discussed? Is it a term that you came up with, or is it out there in you know, tell us how that well, phrase came
so there. So there are some other scholars who are using the term, and again, they're using it in the way that I use it, looking at that in the history of the United States, authoritarianism comes with racism. It doesn't exist separate from that. And this is rooted in a long, long history dating back to terms like America First. So America First gets picked up by people in and around Trump. And we see Trump uses the term. And then when Trump leaves office, many of the people who had been in his administration uses the term as they're creating these far right support efforts. So Stephen Miller, for example, heads up America First Legal, which has become the main one of the main forces that have been challenging affirmative action and diversity programs and explicitly arguing that whites are being discriminated in the U.S. You have the American First Policy Institute and a number of those people Trump is bringing back into his administration. You have the America First Foundation, which was founded by Nicholas Fuentes, who's probably one of the best known white nationalists in the country. And so that term evokes for many people who support Trump this idea that the country was not being given a priority under the Democrats, and that, you know, Trump has decided to, you know, fight for making America first. But the roots of that term goes back decades. I think there's probably some popular knowledge of it being used during the 1930s when there were pro-Hitler and pro-Mussolini forces in the U.S. These were pro-fascist elements, and they used the term. There was an organization called America First. But the term actually goes back to the 20s. The teens in the 20s, in the 20th century, when it was first being articulated by the Ku Klux Klan, the second coming of the Klan as it reemerged in the post-World War I period. And it emerged nationally, not just in the South, but in Indiana, in Michigan, New York, California. It used the term America First. And so it has that etymology to it. And so when we hear this term, there are people who are conscious of that link when they're using it. There are many people who are not. And so part of our work is, you know, educating people on, you know, the roots of these phrases and what they mean in terms of politics today.
Yes. And Chuck, if you have a question, at any time, just jump in.
Okay.
We're speaking with Clarence Lussain, and their theme today is organizing against racial authoritarianism, lessons from the past and preparing for the present. And Clarence, in a moment, we're going to ask you, what are some of the, how can we prepare for this situation? What should we be doing in terms of organizing? But before we get to that, I wanted you to share some of your experiences with a group that you're involved with called ECRI, European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. Tell us about what it is, and I know you recently came back from a special trip where you, I think, met for a whole week with people from different countries.
Okay, thank you for that. About 2.5 years ago, the United States was giving observer status on a commission that's part of the Council of Europe. There are two main regional bodies in Europe, the European Union, which most people are familiar with, which has 27 members, and it's primarily an economic and financial alliance. There's a broader regional organization, the Council of Europe, which has 46 members. It was 47, but Russia was expelled after it invaded Ukraine. And so the Council of Europe is more analogous to the United Nations in that it's very human rights driven. European Court of Human Rights is part of the Council of Europe. And has a number of different commissions, one of which is the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. And it basically functions as kind of a research and monitoring body where it examines how in every country in Europe, issues around racism and intolerance, whether it's around gender, LGBTQ, religious, or otherwise, how those are evolving, and then what can be done and should be done to address that. So when the U.S. received observer status, it was able to nominate somebody to be what they call an independent expert to be a part of the commission. So it ended up being me after a process. And so I go over 3 or 4 times a year, and we have commission meetings where we go over reports looking at different countries and then recommendations. And the other members are experts and people with long histories around these issues and fighting for these issues. So the value for me is that it's an opportunity to talk with people from literally all of the countries in Europe around the issues they're facing, not only around racism and intolerance, but around democracy as well. And as we know, in Romania, in Italy, in Germany, in the UK, in France, in many, many countries, far-right populist forces have also grown as they have here.
And you recently came back from a trip. What were some of the reactions or discussions that were particularly poignant for you? Were people talking a lot about the election here in this country?
Yes, I went over the last plenary we had was a week after the elections here. Over this year, you know, I had a number of discussions and more or less kind of prepared people that the election could go either way, that it was actually possible for Trump to win. People were a bit stunned because, again, you know, Trump had 34 felony convictions. He was on trial for, you know, some other criminal charges. He had lost the case in terms of being convicted of sexual assault. And so it was just kind of unbelievable that he even had a chance. But I, you know, let people know that, you know, given the configuration of the Electoral College, given the politics, given where the Democrats were, it was possible. So when I got there, I received lots of sympathy and lots of kind of condolences as though, I had just lost a family member or something. But again, because of what's evolving in Europe, you know, there was a kind of understanding that we're in a period where it really is going to require a coordinated fight back. And as much as possible, we should think of that not just in national terms, but in international terms as well.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. So let's get into that then. What are you thinking about, Clarence, and how we can really begin to have an organized fight back, and how does that relate to people in other countries? But let's start with this country first. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are quite upset, but whether or not we're really organized to fight back is a question.
So there are a lot of numbers coming out of the election, popular vote, the Electoral College, all of that. To me, the most important number is 89 million. And that's the number of people who were eligible to vote but did not vote. The election turnout was about 64%. That was down from 66% in 2020. But we had 89 million people who either registered and did not vote or who did not register at all, but were eligible to. So that's really a body of people we should start to focus on, because it's disproportionately people of color, disproportionately lower income, working class people, disproportionately young people. And so rather than just kind of say, let's look at the electorate and people who are already voting, let's look at these 89 million people who have disassociated themselves because they're frustrated with the system. They don't see it as beneficial. And what we need to do, which is what the right has done for the last 15, 20 years, is mobilize, organize, and institutionalize, and not have that tied completely to the elections, but not separate from the elections as well. And so what that means is at a grassroots level, we are going to have engagement with people. So all of the issues that people really do feel, from financial insecurity to education to health opportunities, we have to be working on that day to day, not just on waiting for particular elections. Because if we do that, then when elections come around, there's already an active constituency that can be involved and pushing the candidates and people who are running for office on these issues. And that's what we saw with the right. On education, for example, you have groups like Moms for Liberty and some others that day to day today were out there working the school boards, working in the schools, working on those libraries. And they began to really have an impact after a couple years of chilling these libraries and these schools on all of these issues around gender, LGBTQ, and racial justice. And there wasn't an alternative, at least that I could see, that was pushing back. And so that's what we really need to embrace right now. It also means we approach elections differently, which is we flood the zone with people running for office. Now, I know a lot of people find that not their taste, but that 89 million people plus the people who are already voting, there are people there who will represent communities in an effective and progressive way if there is a support mechanism. And again, we're organizing, mobilizing, and institutionalizing these efforts.
Well, I'm wondering how are we going to do that? It seems like what you're saying, Clarence, is that there was not that kind of organizing amongst the Democrats, certainly, and amongst the progressive factions. So how do we begin to become more organized in the immediate future?
No, so I think At one level, there are organizations and there's work going on in communities. I just really want to underscore that. So there's not a blank slate out there on these concerns. But what has been missing has been the resources. There's been the exposure, linking of groups. And so, you know, one model, I think, is what Reverend William Barber, which, you know, a lot of listeners are familiar with, who came out of North Carolina and is doing a lot of work nationally now, but who put together weekly challenges at the state capitol, protests at the state capitol in North Carolina when far-right Republicans took over and were pushing through, you know, very egregious and awful policies. And what Reverend Barber did was to bring together people who had already been organizing, labor unions, community organizations, and gave them a focus. And so that should happen all over the country, where in Michigan and Tennessee and in all of these places where these far-right Republicans have taken over, there's been challenges, but there needs to be much, much more. And again, it shouldn't just be waiting until the time of the election, but it should be occurring, you know, every week, every month, every year. So I think that's where, you know, what people have to look to. So if you're in, you know, wherever you're at in the country, you know, you can begin to tap into the organizations and groups that are there. And again, push really for, you know, increasing the institutional resources that these organizations and groups need, as well as ongoing mobilizing and organizing.
Clarence, I'm interested in wondering about these 89 million people who didn't vote. Do you think they feel a need to vote? Do you think that their votes matter? Or do you think they're just okay with the way things are?
So all of that. So there's not a homogeneity between those 89 million. But I would argue that disproportionately, it's people who do not think that their voting matters and that it changes the system. And that's exactly what far-right populism wants. If we're looking, if you look at, you know, what the incoming Trump administration is saying about elections, they are pushing for more and more restrictions so that even more people will not not only not want to vote, but will not be able to vote. They want to get rid of early voting. They want to get rid of mail-in voting. They want same-day voting. You know, they want to create an atmosphere where you have essentially a 20% turnout or something. So Trump did not, and Trump knows this, he did not win overwhelmingly by any stretch. It was a 64% turnout. He won about half of that. So that means about 32% of the electorate, people who could vote, elected Trump. So that's not overwhelming by any stretch. I think if you begin to tap into that 89 million and you really build out, not only would that benefit like the Democratic Party, which has been losing voters, but the degree to which third parties, like Working Families Party that Joni and I have talked about, and there are other parties, smaller parties, and perhaps new parties that would emerge if people really begin to see a benefit. And again, as I mentioned earlier, part of getting people mobilized around elections is who's actually running. And if we begin to have people running out of these communities, for these offices who are not in it for themselves, but really represent the community they come out of, then you begin to change the electorate and it begins to grow and expand because it really is represented, as opposed to legitimately people do not feel they're being represented now.
This is my last question. Of these 89 million people, where are the majority of them? Are they middle class, upper middle class, or poor?
So they're disproportionately lower income and rural and urban. So there's limited data because there's not been a lot of focus. So the numbers are pretty clear, and the numbers are going to grow actually, because between each election, there's tremendous amount of people who come in who are eligible to vote. So when we look at this year's election numbers, Trump won about 77 million and Harris won about 75. And then there's a couple of other million that went to Robert Kennedy and Jill Stein and like that. Trump, if he had really been winning overwhelmingly because of the number of new people that entered the who became eligible to vote, then he should have probably gotten at least 4 or 5 million more. So what I see coming out of the 2024 election is the support for the Democrats collapse. There was some increase for Trump, but minimal. But it was mostly that 89 million that said, we just can't be bothered. We do not see what we're going to kind of get out of this. And I do think, Chuck, if there is more detailed analysis, it will overwhelmingly be people on the lower end of the financial and economic scale, people who are mostly marginalized, as well as like young people, for example.
You're listening to WPFW 89.3 To Heal DC with me, Joni, and Chuck. And we're speaking with Dr. Clarence Lussain around the issue of organizing against racial authoritarianism, lessons from the past and preparing for the present. And I'm tempted to invite people to call in. We don't usually do that, but if anyone wants to ask Clarence a question, give us a call on 202-588-0893. And Clarence, when we talk about lessons from the past, what lessons might we reflect on from this country in particular, perhaps from the 20s or 30s or other eras that might be helpful for us now to think about?
Yeah, so if you look at the eras where there's been the most mass mobilization, the 1930s, in part in response to the Great Depression, and in the 1960s, early 1970s, in response to the Civil Rights Movement and Black Power movements, these were very organic, and they emerged out of people confronting the issues that were right in their face, and then expanded beyond that. And it was young people that led these movements who simply could not find a way in which the contemporary political forces were addressing their concerns. And so we're kind of in that era now. It's hard to believe, but there are people who somehow think that Trump's populism is going to address their concerns. It is not. And I think that will become apparent fairly quickly. Now, what we're seeing in response to this is a surge of far-right policies that will be coming driven by billionaires but also by these authoritarian aims. And so Trump has said on his first day, he's going to try to release people who were arrested for January 6th. So this is a clear message that committing violence on my behalf is okay, and you will be protected. And because Trump has immunity, he can issue pardons all day long without kind of consequences. So this is the signal kind of coming from the other side. From our side, we have to not despair and really begin to see that there are these millions and millions and millions of people who do not support MAGA and who can be mobilized, who can be organized, and we can institutionalize these movements. So that's, you know, the message I think we have to get out. You know, I talk to people, you know, all over the country about these issues. And, you know, the first thing I ask people, you know, in your local area, you know, what kind of community organizations, civil society organizations, grassroots organizations exist and kind of what they're doing. And, you know, if you spend a minute, you can start to identify groups locally who are working on these issues and these concerns. And so, you know, that, and then, you know, there are groups working on it nationally, internationally as well.
And Clarence, we have a caller. Hello, caller, your name and your question.
Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Yes, I just had a quick comment. My name is Tricia Kinch. I'm chair of the D.C. Justice for All Committee for Cornel West and Melina Abdullah. I just wanted to thank Joni, Clarence, and PFW for bringing this vital information. This was an excellent show. Thank you so much. This is what we need to keep it moving. To keep moving forward. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for the work you are doing as well. And I had Clarence mentioned the Working Families Party. As some of us know, that was started in New York about 26 years ago. It's very well known in New York. But they're starting to organize more around the whole country, and we hope to have them on at some point in the future. In fact, I think they're having a national Zoom call tomorrow. But I think that's one example of different kinds of organizing that is taking place. We have another caller. Okay, caller, your name and your comment or question.
Hey, good morning. I think the discussion should be more positive, because out of chaos comes opportunity. No administration can come in and whatever they want to. People have to implement whatever policies are being proposed. If the Democrats or any other party actually started to propose real policy changes, such as single payer, then people will be excited. People don't get organized around ideology. They get organized around doing certain things because they can imagine those certain things improving their lives. So what we need to do is start forcing and going on the offense, to stop talking about being defensive and assuming they're going to do certain things, and say, well, whoever's in the office, we have to have a specific agenda of items that we want to see accomplished, and then people will go through and begin to do what's necessary to accomplish those goals. And that's where I would like to see the discussion for, because all the stuff around healthcare, well, we need to force the system to do a single payer. We need to force the system to come up with a better way to fund Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the time for opportunity, and that's for the time for lamenting, because these people are incompetent, and Trump proved the first time he couldn't do what he wanted, and he's not going to do what he wanted the second time either.
Okay, caller. Well, I appreciate your thought. As I often say on this show, we have been organizing for universal health care in this country since the Civil War, and I certainly have been involved with the single-payer movement of course, we need to organize more, but many people out there have been organizing for single payer. So I guess the question is, how do we become better organized to demand and implement and fight for what we need? Clarence, what would you say?
So first, let me say, I think the call is absolutely right. We have to be optimistic, and we do have to be on the offensive, although we often get put on the defensive, but we have to do both. One of the things that we did not have in this election was an alternative to Project 2025. And not only in terms of a defining document that essentially lays out what we think government should look like and what policies we think should be there, not only on healthcare, but criminal justice, education, and so forth, but the process by which Project 2025 unfolded was that it brought together hundreds of conservative organizations to have input into that. And that's, you know, the kind of, again, organizing, mobilizing that we need to do as well, so that we have a document that's a reference point for people around the country, again, on all of these issues, as the caller talked about.
Absolutely. Okay, we have several more callers. Good morning, caller. Your name and your question or comment.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. It's Star from Washington, D.C. And, well, I have a number of concerns. Very interesting program, and thank you for it. I think that we have to be cautious about just looking at the numbers of people that would benefit from a true democracy and a program for social justice, because the overwhelming number of people are oppressed under capitalism. Even middle-class white people, if they lose work for 3 months, you know, they can be in a crisis. The ruling, you know, the corporate structure has always ruled through our ideas. If people were clear about what they represent, then we would overwhelmingly be able to vanquish them. But they keep us fooled. And one of them is in what some people call bourgeois democracy, which is democracy for the wealthy. So we need to be aware of that. If you look at 1933, Hitler's Germany, he was elected not by a majority of people, but by a plurality. And within 3 months, he enacted legislation so that you could be jailed and a whole lot worse if you basically defied any of his edicts. And I don't say that that's going to happen immediately with Trump, but the corporate structure isn't going to sit by and let us just, you know, grow exponentially by getting the word out. And we need to be aware of that. And I think one of the things that is related that really concerns me, I agree totally that we don't have any kind of unifying vision or program. But I think across the board, there just seems to be kind of an overwhelming omission of the fact that no social justice programs are going to come about until we have a complete tie-in with imperialist policies. The Pentagon budget is sucking up all of the money right now, or a good portion of it. And I think that's a critical point that's just left out. Thanks very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Star. Clarence, if you could briefly comment, and then we have one last caller we're going to squeeze in. Did you have
No, I think, I think she's right, particularly when we talk about the disproportionate way in which the priorities of the country get focused towards militarism. So that, again, is an ongoing effort that we need to maintain, to challenge.
Okay, we have two more callers, and we're almost out of time. I'm going to ask both callers to briefly make their comment or question, and then Clarence will have the last word. Caller, your name and your comment quickly.
Hello.
Yes, it's you.
Joni, I was wondering, I've tried to explain to my friends why Medicare Advantage is just a backdoor way of them to destroy Medicare. Could you expand on that a little bit for us?
Well, I think we're going to need to do actually regular shows, regular updates about Medicare Advantage. You're absolutely correct. It's a way of privatizing Medicare. It's growing the numbers of people that are under Medicare Advantage, and it's very, very, very dangerous. So thank you, caller. We will be talking about that again in the future, because that is one of our major threats in our healthcare system is the privatization of Medicare. So we will be coming back to that issue, absolutely. So we have one last caller comment real quick.
Hi, how you doing? This is Nana Malaya. What's up, Joni?
Hey.
And guests?
Hey, Nana Malaya.
I just want to say, of course, thanks for the work you do each week. I think what's most important is for the community in general to focus forward. By that, I mean we have to start acting more and reacting less. Of course, there's things we have to respond to. We do need more measures. We need to put some things in place. There's a lots of organizations who are doing things. They're happening sometimes in a vacuum. We don't know what they're doing. However, I think the people who are suffering the most, the lowest economic structure, no one's really spending that time in the street. But the people who don't have time to idealize about plans, they just need to get from day to day. And those are the folks who I don't think, as a group, we're getting to, and we need to do more sessions with them, have events where we get people out, we know we can feed them, we can talk to them, and then we can help them plan. But it has to be that their needs are getting met. Otherwise, they're not going to be out. And I know a lot of young folks who are just disillusioned with the whole system and how it hasn't worked for us. So that's what we need to do, mobilize and spend less money with other people who aren't doing anything with us as well.
Thank you, Nana Malaya. Very good point.
All right. Okay. Peace and love.
Peace and love to you, Nana Malaya. Clarence, you have the couple minutes for your final comments.
So I just want to echo the point that I forget who someone made. Thanks to all the callers. But someone made the point, crisis is an opportunity. And I think that's absolutely true. When we look in the past, and we see where there were major advances for people's movements and for mass mobilizations, it was because people responded to a crisis. But that could go in either direction. And so we have to, this is why we have to be vigilant, because the far right is very serious. And, you know, they're very determined to take this country in a direction. You've got ideologues, you've got extreme Christian nationalists. You've got a range of folks out there on the other side that are not going to sleep, and they think they have an opportunity with this incoming Trump administration and Republicans controlling Congress, having control of the courts. But it opens up space for us to begin to think and imagine in very, very different ways how we want to move forward. It means moving beyond the Democratic Party as it exists. It is not capable, in my opinion, at this point, of meeting the challenge of the far right. And that leadership that has existed for the last 10 or 15 years simply cannot do it. Outside of the Democratic Party, of course, there's also our need to really be on the ground, as the last caller said, engaging, talking with people about their more immediate needs, but also framing that in the context of there has to be democratic structures and processes in order for all of that to happen. So again, thank you, Joni, for the show and the opportunity to talk about some of the context I see in my understanding, what I would call a racial authoritarian moment.
And thank you, Clarence Hussein. And of course, we will have you back in the future, and you're very much a part of our WPFW family. I want to thank all the callers who called in.
Thanks, as always, to Magic Mike. Thanks to Mari, who helps us out. And thanks to Chuck. Chuck, one more time, your phone number for people who want to help.
202-421-8608.
Okay, that's if you'd like to help Chuck with the delivery of presents to young people and women in shelters.
Say it clear, we gotta change around here. Gotta change around here. Gotta change around here. Yeah. Lord, gotta change around here. Say it loud, say it clear. We gotta change around here.
During our upcoming end-of-year pledge drive from December 15th through the 21st, WPFW offers you the gift of knowledge as we dedicate the week to Brothers of Culture and Resistance, Bill Lucy, Quincy Jones, and Amiri Baraka. On Monday, December 16th, we commemorate Bill Lucy and the Black Workers Movement. Wednesday, December 18th, it's From the Pen of Q, a Quincy Jones retrospective. We close with Baraka at 90 on Thursday, December 19th. Detailed schedule at WPFWFM.org. You can give the gift of knowledge anytime by texting WPFWFM to 801-801, helping us to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. If you're already a cherished member of the WPFW Jazz and Justice Circle and your contributions this year have not reached $1,000, your membership will expire on New Year's Eve. To renew your membership or become a new member of the Jazz and Justice Circle through the end of 25, donations can be made during our year-end fund drive from December 15th through the 21st. Anytime before December 31st, Jazz and Justice Circle donations can be made several ways. By calling 202-588-9739 during the pledge drive. By visiting WPFWFM.org and clicking on the big red Donate Now button. Via Cash App at $WPFWFM or via text by simply texting WPFWFM to 80181 and following the clear and easy prompts.
On Saturday, December 14th, from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m., WPFW and the King Solomon Grand Lodge host a winter coat and clothing drive. Donations of lightly used winter coats, hats, gloves, socks, and more can be dropped off at 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast. This is a one-day collection drive with distribution to those in need to occur on New Year's Day, beginning at 10 a.m. from the lodge. Additional information can be found online at WPFWFM.org or by calling the King Solomon Grand Lodge at 202-378-3843. WPFW, our organizational partners and dedicated listeners, continue to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings, this is Brother Jamil, host of Yardbird Sweets. During this season of lights, we ask that you remember WPFW and the sustenance we provide to the community. You can give the gift of WPFW from December 15th through December 31st during our year-end membership campaign. It is indeed your generosity that has allowed WPFW to provide news, music, and information to the people since 1977. Donations can be made anytime at WPFW.org or by calling 800-222-9739. We wish you truth and peace now and in the new year. Peace, everyone. I'm Brother Jamil, and in the Yardbird Suites tradition established by our dear brother Askia Muhammad, we continue every Tuesday morning from 5 to 8, playing some things you've never heard before and also playing some old favorites. But we invite you to join us each and every Tuesday as we have an audio family reunion right here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington. Peace.